You're listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network, now the largest new media platform on the web and your number one source for after-show entertainment.
Very good, Gene Johnson.
From the AfterBuzz Studios in Los Angeles, California, presented by Maria Menounos and Bing.com, and streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies, this is AfterBuzz TV's Mad Men After Show. We'll break down tonight's episode and get you all the latest news and gossip. If you'd like to buzz in on tonight's show, you can buzz us at 424-256-1729. That's 424-256-1729. And now, another post-game wrap-up show for your favorite TV show. It's AfterBuzz TV's Mad Men After Show.
Mad Men, Mad Men, Mad Men, Mad Men, Mad Men, Mad Men.
Ooh, Bing is for doing, and we are doing the Mad Men After Show. I'm here. My name is Joe Braswell. I'm here joined by my three best friends. We're all here together.
Three best friends.
The whole world. Actually, my four best friends. Marissa Serafini's over there, too. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Marissa Serafini on the ones and twos.
I do have to my left, Mr. Matthew Lieberman.
Hello, hello.
And I have to his left, Catherine Julich.
Hello.
And to her left, Mr. Joe Sanfilippo.
Hey guys.
And over. Oh, we already talked about Marissa. She's over there. She's doing it all.
What's up, guys?
Hi. So, well, last week we weren't all together. This week we are all together. It's been a while since we've been all together, the four of us, but we're here. And for what episode? The Tale of Two Cities.
Yes.
Mad Men episode 10. You know, it seems like people say to start off to a slow start, but we're coasting right into the finale here. Not a bad episode so far in the last four episodes, right?
Yeah.
I think we're doing really well here. So this one is directed by Slattery, our favorite.
Yes.
Another Crackerjack episode. But this way, he was actually in the episode a lot, so he did a lot of directing himself. The last episode, he seemed to get a couple little zingers in there, then kind of back out and go to work, but this time he stayed in and did a lot of work.
Lots of fun zingers, and we got to see him torment Danny Siegel, who was back.
He was mean. He was mean to poor Danny. That was rough and tumble.
Yeah, but then he did get punched in the dick for it.
Yes. He did get punched in the dick.
Sucker punched. Pow!
Danny gave
dick punch.
What he deserved.
Yeah,
and so lots going on. So lots of turmoil over at CGC, SCDP, or SCDCB, CGC.
No, you do it. SC and P.
Well, now it's SC ampersand P.
Yes.
But you had the other one down perfectly last week.
Oh, the other one is SCDPCGC.
Oh.
It is now SC and P.
Right.
SC and P. I feel like this episode, in a lot of ways, was just kind of laying track for the rest of the season. Like, we got a lot of development from all the characters last week. We got some great, Don and Betty stuff. This week, they're establishing the central conflict of our final three episodes, namely that there is internal turmoil within this merged agency.
Yep.
And Cutler is about to mess some stuff up.
Maybe.
Yeah. Power play.
What I liked about this episode was kind of getting back to business in many ways, wasn't it? This was all really about the advertising business. It was all their clients. It was that's what I really loved. It was kind of back to the office, back to business. That's what I liked about this episode.
I talk about that a lot. I said I like the office stuff more than I like the personal stuff. So this was all office, and it was really I loved it all. So we'll break these down by the clients, because each of the clients they had its own storyline, which is very cool and great to see as well. And
you could say it was a tale of four clients.
Yes, you could say that. But they said it was a tale of two cities.
All right.
Actually, it's a tale of three cities if you count Chicago, because there's a lot going on politically in this episode as well.
Yeah, four cities, Detroit.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He goes to talk to Chevy.
Five cities.
I'm saying.
All right. Well, the one thing I will say about this episode is they do, they talk a lot about Mad Men, how they use the political landscape or the historical landscape to maybe tell some stories. We all knew 1968 is jam-packed with a lot of socio-political events, a lot of, history-defining events. So we were all sort of anxious to see how, Matt Weiner would, you know, would deal with all these events and as it juxtaposing against the characters. And I think that it's a good balance because some episodes it informed all the characters and surrounding the characters. Some episode, like when Bobby Kennedy was shot, it was kind of a thing at the end, a little punctuation. Yeah. This one we see. It's sort of like there's turmoil happening in Chicago and the Democratic Convention, and it really does inform the characters in different ways and also the clients in some ways. So it's really kind of cool the way they injected all that, which we will get to very shortly. We went back to this episode, but first, I do want to say, you know, here at AfterBuzz, we do some lovely shows for you. We have like 60 plus or 50 plus shows we do for you. We rarely, really ask you for anything here, but we give you quality programming, and we do it for the love of television and you. But as you all know, we have our creators Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro have done a wonderful movie called Serial Buddies, which we all know and love. And if you listen to AfterBuzz, you're very familiar with it. You may or may not know by now, it is available on demand right now on iTunes. So if you're listening to this via iTunes, you know how to work iTunes. You can go over there and get Serial Buddies on iTunes as well. It's a hilarious movie. Maria's in it, has Artie Lang, Beth Bears, has my man Henry Winkler in it. It's got Kathleen Gifford, who else? A bunch of people.
Christopher Lloyd.
Lloyd's in it.
Christopher McDonald,
the very hilarious improv king, Christopher McDonald. So,
and one of the leads, Gian Molina, he's a friend of mine. He's really, really talented, really funny performer. And he's great in the movie.
Yeah,
and one of the leads is an Aussie too, Paul Ashton.
There you go. It's a family affair here. You know, my co-host John Comerford on Justified is also in the movie. And the lovely Tamara Berg does some costuming in the movie, and so we're all part of it in some way, shape, or form. If you want to stream it immediately, you can go to serialbuddies.com and just click there and watch it and stream it there, or you can download it from iTunes. But when you do that, you're helping us here at AfterBuzz bring you wonderful, great programming. So please do that whenever you can. That's all I got to say to that. Now, back to Mad Men.
Mad Men.
Let's jump right into this. So, I want to get into CGC, SEDP.
SEDP, CGC?
All right, whatever. I want to get into it because we're like, so we open, as these episodes tend to do these days, we open in the boardroom, right? I'm really, really looking forward to these boardroom, the conference room scenes, because a lot happens in this conference room because you have all these great personalities. You get to see Chaw do his thing, you know, and Chaw versus Draper and you know, Cutler versus Sterling. And Pete's always, you know, angsty about something or other. And, you know, and Jones doing something or other. So we open there, and the debate seems to be about what are we going to do about this name?
Yeah.
And it seems to be sort of a point of contention of, like, what are we going to call ourselves?
I just want to point out, we do all these conference room scenes, and Don is always late to every single one.
And what does he say every time? Are we done here?
Are we done here?
Are we done here?
What is this?
It's got no interest in...
Zero. Yeah. It's epic.
Yeah.
So we start to see some clients are divvied out, but we start to see the real politics here, and with, you know, Cutler, who, by the way, has a very meaty role this time around. We haven't heard much from Harry Hamlin. He's been kind of cool, laid back, wearing the glasses, but he actually got some character work here. We actually got to see who this guy is, and I'm not sure I like him, actually.
I love what he's doing. I think he's just like, he's just playing this character with nothing. He's like, I'm a guy who just wants things. I want them right now. I have enough money that I don't care.
Right.
And so he's like a kid. He's I love watching him.
He's kind of anti-Roger.
Yeah, but they're so the same. It's such a weird, like,
they serve similar functions, and they're both pretty outward with their wants.
Yeah.
Right.
But Roger is charming and Jim is not.
Yeah. Jim is awkward about it.
Yeah. Jim just, like, he's kind of an Asperger's kid a little bit.
Yeah,
it feels not quite right.
He's just kind of off. Like, when he screams at, like, he's just kind of placid, then Bob Benson comes in that scene with Ginsburg, and he's like, what are you doing down here? Why are you always here? Like, he's just placid until he explodes, and he doesn't really have any other emotions.
And then the funny thing is, when he goes after that explosion on Benson, then he goes and talks to Chaw, and he's kind of like, I want to reshuffle our creative. Like, let's get rid of Ginsburg. He was very calm about it and very matter of fact about it. He wasn't going in steaming. And Charles like, you're mad. You're upset. It's like, no, I'm fine.
And it's not. It wasn't even just let's get rid of Ginsburg. It's just let's just fire all of their people. Well, you know, while they're out of town, let's do it.
What I like about it though is that he needs to go to Ted first. He can't just do it. Like, obviously understands himself well enough that the way he's written, he understands himself well enough to know he just can't go off and do it. He has to check in with somebody first because they're writing him like he knows. I know I'm a little crazy, so I'm going to go check in with an adult and make sure I'm allowed to do what I want to do.
But also, this the CGC is really only CG. You know, I mean, CC. Excuse me, it's only CC. You know, Gleason's gone, so it's really just the two of them. And which is also, you know, the hubris of the two of them saying, like, you know, us two know way better than these four guys. These four, five, six, seven a-holes over here. The two of us and our team is way better than these guys.
Yeah.
And so what we're starting to see is the division of there is not. It's this fight between people want to say we're all in the same, we're all together, we're all one big team versus some people, you know, maybe Campbell included, maybe Roger to a certain degree, certainly Cutler. It's us against them. Well, there are people against our people.
How many people in this agency really want it to be a unified agency? I think maybe Peggy's one of them. Chaw's potentially another. But how many other people really see this merger as anything other than it kept us afloat when we were drowning?
I don't know.
I get the vibe Ted is behind it. I get the vibe that Chaw's in it.
Yeah.
He's in it now.
Well, he's the one that said to Cutler, too, it's not just us and them. You know, you have to stop thinking that way. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that just comes from just human nature of, like, these are my guys. I don't know those people over there. I know what we're doing because it's a top-down thing, right? Okay. So from the top, they're like, well, those are our people. Those are you know, our people and your people. But amongst the employees, you know, I think it's sort of like more of a cliquish thing. I think that if it came from the top, like we're all a big family, I think people will start to work together, in theory. That's what I think.
Yeah. But any merger is going to be tough. I mean, you're always going to feel aligned to the people that you were working with originally. So, I mean, how are you ever going to succeed, especially in the short term like that when you still have, you know, it's still fresh.
Just look at the landscape. Mm-hmm. Look at the people who are still at this company. The majority of the people are SCDP people.
Right.
A lot of the people who got let go were CGC folks.
Right. Which is what Cutler is having some remorse over.
Yeah.
He's like, I think we let the wrong people go.
And he feels like he has no control over this company. And you know, that scene with Ginsburg really touched a nerve. And we now know that Cutler has nerves to touch.
What I like about this, though, is it's kind of, you know, we're seeing the inside, we're seeing the warts and all inside baseball growing pains of a merger. But if you zoom out, at the end of the day, they started in a conference room, they had a conversation about what's going to be what, they went off and they had their crazy tumultuous separate adventures with all the different clients. But at the end of the day, Ford's okay, Menashevitz is gone, they were on their way out of the
way.
Chevy's okay. GM and Chevy's okay. Menashevitz was on their way out. Who cares? Avon's new, and Carnation, you know, meh. But guess what? We're still ahead. They walked into this kind of like, what are we gonna do? The end of the episode, the agency was still ahead. They found a name. No one died. Everything's fine.
But a plot is afoot.
Well, I think we didn't spend enough time on. Cutler took a lot of abuse from Ginsburg. I mean, that did not come out of left field. I mean, I think we're all kind of glossing over the fact.
I want to get into it. I'm definitely.
Yeah, but I mean, like in the way we're kind of looking at this particular thing about Cutler going to Chaw and saying, "I want to fire this guy," he lit him up and he made him a fascist and a Nazi and his boot on his neck.
Well, he is.
And
Well, I mean, we'll get into this more when we get into.
I just say I think it's germane to the point. Well, he was much abused.
Yeah. We'll get into that more, but I do want to touch on that without stepping on anything else. I do want to touch on the fact how, you know, it is, again, back to it being 1968, and the times are definitely, you're feeling and seeing the times, you know, permeate throughout all of, you know, all the show, all the episodes. But, you know, the employees of SCDP, CGC are feeling it. You know, they're really, you know, choosing sides, and they're watching these things happen on television. They're really feeling like, am I part of the problem? Am I, you know, am I part of the machine? Am I the man? You know, Cutler had that line, you know, where he told Ginsburg.
You have no problem cashing checks from General Motors. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and I think that does a great job of sort of like really showing both sides, because there's a lot of emotions being stirred at this time, and we saw what was going on with Megan at home and how Don was reacting to it. And usually Don is usually pretty apolitical, but he seemed a little more interested than usual this time around.
It does seem to be the younger ones are a little more stirred by this, you know, like Ginsburg, Megan, like the older ones are a little more, I mean, that's kind of the opposition, isn't it?
Sure.
Like they're looking at them as the establishment and whatever, but they are part of it. So they can't really complain that they're, you know, that they're somehow got these morals that these other guys don't have because, you know, they're working there too.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing when you have, you know, you talk about Madison Avenue Firm, you have the establishment, which is populated by a bunch of young creatives. So it's like, it is this weird, you know, sort of, you know, I don't know, problem here. If you where we have like, you know, we're the young guys, we're also the establishment. What do we do? Kind of the A-Peggy problem.
Well, you look at the division, you know, people who are Don's age, you know, he's 40 or so, you know. He went through the Korean War. You know, he's seen things. Like Vietnam is not a huge as massive an injustice to him. These riots are not as massive of an injustice to him because he's lived through, in his mind, worse.
Well, he did. If you grew up in the Depression, it's very difficult for you to have a tremendous amount of sympathy, I would imagine, for people protesting a war in 1968 that hasn't really gone all that crazy yet. It hasn't gone where it's going to go. I mean, it does escalate in the next couple of years. They don't know that yet. But you know, it's very difficult to take someone who grew up that way and say, hey, sympathize. These kids had everything you didn't have. They had a booming economy they grew up in. They don't want to go fight. You know, there's a lot of those guys at the top going, well, too damn bad. Yeah. That's where all this comes from. And so I do think you're right. It is generational, but it's also financial. And it's also people who've really come to terms with who they are and accept who they are, and people who are dealing with, for the first time, probably Ginsburg is the one that leaps to mind, figuring out who you are in this equation and having the mirror shined up to you for the first time. That's jarring when you find out, wait a second, I am absolutely a cog in this wheel. I am become death.
Destroyer
because
of worlds.
You're an adult.
I just want to point out, it's almost like there's a scale. If you look at a scale from you know, young and far liberal, like, let's say the hippies who are on the ground during these riots, you know, and you move all the way to apolitical, where you have people who are mostly older. You look at someone like Cutler, who, you know, he just doesn't share his opinions.
Ginsburg said he doesn't have any sons.
Yeah. You know, he doesn't have an opinion. Pinging all the way over past the people who are laughing about it, to the guy Frank who came in
from the Carmation
meeting.
Absolutely.
Who was furious, and for a second I was like, oh my god, is this guy about to be like, this is an injustice, kind of like Pete did when Martin Luther King was shot? He's like, no, those damn hippies are ruining this country.
They're an embarrassment.
They're a
big
shame.
Opinion then, of course, from a lot
and,
of people
and,
like that.
And Nixon's an opportunist, and the only person who can fix this is Dutch Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
Oh, Dutch.
I know you're not from this country, but
I've never heard that term.
We had
Dutch.
This president.
Dutch.
His name was Ronald.
Yeah.
He
was Dutch back then, back in the 60s. Governor Dutch Reagan.
I didn't know it was Dutch.
But
sorry.
Before we want to get into the Carnation in LA, but I just want to say one more thing about the whole that confrontation with Cutler is that there is that moment where, like you're saying, when you do realize if you're a guy like Ginsburg, like, oh my god, I'm an adult, am I part of this problem? But what they did a really good job of in this episode of it is sort of not demonizing the older people. Like, Cutler is not really demonized here. Cutler's a real guy. Like he said, he's like, what about you? He also said, I served in the Air Force. What did you do?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like, there's both sides here. It's not just as simple as, you're the old guy, you're the fascist, you're the establishment, you have the tie on.
Roger said it. He said his therapist has told him his job as a human is to figure out who he is and then figure out who you are, and then you'll be surprised how much you love yourself. Right? Isn't that what the therapist?
The job of your life is to know yourself.
Is to know yourself.
Yeah. That was the line.
But
that's kind of the theme of the whole show,
that's
right?
That's what I'm saying. That's the whole thing.
Don Draper, everyone.
So for the first time, Ginsburg is seeing himself.
Yeah.
So, like, hey, here's who you are. You are a cog in this wheel. You shine this ugly machine up and make it palatable. That's your job right now. Roger has no problems with who he is. Roger's completely, he's old, he's completely, he's cooked.
I wouldn't say that. No, I think he just knows how to hide them.
I think we saw plenty of issues with Roger last week.
I think so too. I think he more knows how to hide them. Not to disagree with Joe.
Versus someone like Cutler, who feels because he served in the Air Force, he did his time, he made his money, he's earned the right to deal with it or not deal with it. He's earned the right to say, whatever flaws I have, I don't care.
Can I ask you this? Is Roger comfortable with his position in the grand scheme of things as far as politically? Is Roger comfortable with who he is in the company and politically?
I think that he is because he's always been safe. Yeah. Roger comes from money. He's never had to struggle. And everything, even when things get hard, eventually goes his way. He's on a winning streak.
I agree with that 100%. I want to get into California here because there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay.
I do just want to say one last thing. Yeah, Sterling has not had a care in the world. Has never had a care in the world in that his name's on the door. He's always been fine. He had that one dust up with Pete where he had to try to prove himself, like, Pete, I can still get clients. Other than that, he's Roger Sterling. He doesn't have a bit of insecurity about who he is in regards to that company at all. Never has. I don't think he ever will.
No.
That's my opinion on that. But so much so that, you know, segue, when they go to California, like, he's on autopilot. He's like telling Don.
Yeah, he's not even paying attention.
You know, he's telling Don, you know, look, buddy, like, we're from New York. We're these guys, you know, we're from New York. We're ad guys. We're big shots from New York. We come in there. In California, what are they doing out there?
We come from an ad firm on Madison Avenue with seven initials in our name.
And you know what? That's the truth. And they do feel that way. And they got a rude awakening with that a little bit. But I do want to say, I love when the show goes to California, man.
Oh, I love
it's
the way
so
they portray
great.
California.
It's so great. Now, I mean, well, it's great because, you know, it's great when they go to California, but you can't have a 1968 without a trip to California.
Yeah.
You got to see what it's like in California tonight because that's where it's cracking. That's where it's all going down. And it very much reminded me of Annie Hall when Diane Keaton and then Woody and go out to L.A. and go to the big L.A. party. And it's kind of like these New Yorkers, completely fish out of water New Yorkers in this L.A. scene. It's very much a little Annie Hall going in there, which I liked a lot. But we do see these guys arrive in Los Angeles, you know, hair blown from the Ford convertible.
Yeah,
they're not supposed to have. And Harry Crane's just like, well, who cares?
Crane's in his element because he's there in L.A., but he's a bit of a fish out of water too because he's like wide-eyed looking for movie producers and this is going to be big. But he's a little more excited than he should be and not exactly comfortable. But, man, talk about, you know, just they could not stick out any further as New Yorkers.
I love that. I love that when Roger and Don are in New York, their game is so deep they can't be stopped. But you take them and you drop them in California this time. And it was just, it was awful.
Well, it's just the times that are changing.
Absolutely.
You know, drop them in California in 1962, 63, they're all right. 1968, they're a couple of old guys in suits.
They're uncool.
He was just mean, man. Roger was just mean to poor Danny.
Don's the only guy in a tie in that whole party. And, you know, and it, as cool as he looked. He's the only guy in a tie. There's some blazers, but he's the only guy in a tie and a handkerchief or a pocket square, and they looked a little out of place. I don't know.
Roger was wearing an ascot and a double-breasted captain's blazer.
He's ready to go.
I don't know if it's officially a double-breasted captain. I don't know if that's what you call it, but that's, you know.
So they go to there to meet with Carnation. We're going to talk about Carnation. And then Roger seems to not be worried about this meeting. Don wants to be prepared. They get there. They think they can just, you know, drop him on the table. And it'll be going to be fine, and they get a rude awakening flip.
They are sorely mistaken. First off, their game has been shut off since they landed. They have not had any swagger, anything going right in California. It didn't feel right. I don't think they had they weren't flowing at all. But it was Frank, right? Frank was our guy from Carnation that shut them down. Oh, so-and-so was just saying Nixon's going to sweep in. And you would think that would be in a boardroom of a huge company like Carnation, getting anything Republican would be nice and safe. And he just shut that down.
Well, did he really? This is the way I read that was, he said, there'll be no talking of politics in my office, but Dutch Reagan's the man.
Right. And furthermore.
It's like, right. You know, so he didn't even proceed to talk about politics. You know?
Oh, that's awesome.
These hippies are running the country. So, you know, but he's the boss. He can do that.
But it was kind of cool though, because we had that sense. I don't know. I think, you know, we all have that sense that there was two sides, but there was not two sides. There was these guys, those guys, and then those guys way over there, and then mm-hmm. those guys somewhere in the middle that wound up putting Reagan in there a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. It's really I really got a kick out of that. Like you assume the boardroom would be all Republican, you just didn't know how far to the right the boardroom was going to go.
So how did that meeting go? Let's talk about the meeting itself.
Yeah, it was not a good meeting.
Well, actually, no. It started out not as a good meeting, but you know, I think Roger proved himself as an account guy as Roger, and he turned it around. Like when it was going bad. Roger said he diffused one sentence and diffused the whole thing. And he said, well, sorry about your last group. They called them. They called them out on their whole, like, you New York guys, you breeze in here, you think you're hot shit. You don't, it's noon for us. You're already out of the office. It's morning for us. You guys are at lunch. Like, screw you guys.
You know what? Not for anything. Anybody who's worked with the East Coast in business. That's a damn truth, though. They're not wrong. Sure. You call it is absolutely a thing.
All right.
But what did he say?
But he defused it, and he said, "I'm sorry. Your ex-girlfriend was mean to you, but we're here now."
Yeah.
And I thought that was really smooth. But when he came back to the office, he said everything was a bust. So I don't think they got any. I don't think they got it.
Well, it's because they never had a shot in hell when they got into that room. It was a poison room the moment that Frank
absolutely.
Got in there. Right. He was never going to listen to anything they had to say.
No. I mean, the meeting didn't. Nobody got lit on fire, but I don't think they got any new business out of it.
So out of the meeting, they go to a party. They go to the Hollywood Hills, a party in the hills, which is great. Which is great because, you know, he's like, we're from Los Angeles, so we know. And people who listen to us may not be from Los Angeles, but you know, there's that thing, the hills, the Hollywood Hills,
Beverly Hills.
Yeah, there's like Beverly Hills.
No,
but so they go to the party in the hills, and the party was awesome.
Party was awesome, yeah. And they ran into their old best friend Danny Siegel, Jane's cousin.
Yeah, we had to reset who Danny Siegel is.
We had to do a little research on this to make sure we got this right. But Danny Siegel, I don't know if you guys remember the Life episode many, many moons ago. He was an interview that Don and Roger gave as a favor. And all his pitches were the same. Yeah. The cure for the common blah, blah, blah. Whatever it was, insert your product here. And then Don went into a pitch meeting drunk after the Clio Awards. He was drunk as a lord, and he went into a pitch meeting with Life. And he was just throwing things out there. And for whatever reason, the cure for the common whatever.
Breakfast.
Right. Had lodged in his head. And so he tossed that out at Life. And, of course, that's the one Life wanted, and that's what they went with. And then Don had to, you know, he tried to buy Danny off. Danny wouldn't take anything less than a job, so Danny got hired.
And now Danny produces movies.
Yes, which is a theme here. This is a thing where, like, there's this East Coast, West Coast thing where, like, you have the East Coast creatives, you have the West Coast creatives, right? And the East Coast creatives are the ad guys, and they're smartest guys in the room. And the Hollywood guys are the movie guys and the TV guys, and they think they're the smartest guys in the room. So it's a real thing where there's a real level of contempt there where when you see a guy who you fired or you let go in some capacity, and he's out here and he's a big shot in LA. First of all, you have contempt for LA. You have contempt for the movie business. Here's this little guy looking like Sonny Bono, you know, with Lotus. It's like,
cool,
I think that was played perfectly by, you know, his part. But again, you see both sides, you know, you see both sides.
So. Yeah. But then Don walks away to, you know, through this party, and like you look at someone like Roger and Harry who have no game. Don doesn't even have to try. And he automatically has game with the woman that Roger wanted at the beginning.
I have an extra nipple for you.
Yeah.
Who
when
gets
you get
told
back.
He has an Don Draper.
Very lucky man.
Don Draper's the man, I know.
Sure. He smokes some hashish.
Not a good idea if you've never tried it before.
Don should learn by now not to sort of alter his state.
He doesn't do good with that, does he?
He does not do well with altered states, and yet he continues to do it. It just kind of triggers these long emotional things in him that, you know,
some deep-seated underneath that can't be unpacked on the drugs.
Well, drugs amplify whatever you've got going on, and he sees...
So I've heard.
He sees a vision
of people.
I want to talk about, he has two visions. He has a vision of Megan as this pregnant hippie goddess
who belongs in Los Angeles.
Who belongs in Los Angeles?
She looked good there, actually.
Where Don says he always feels better in Los Angeles, except not this time. He got a cold from falling into the pool. Not only does she belong in Los Angeles, she came there for him because she needs him. She quit her job. And she's going to have a baby because that's a second chance for them. You know, it's his vision of what he thinks the next stage of their, or the perfect version of their relationship would be. She is the willing sycophant who's willing to give up her career and raise kids, you know, and be more traditional and not challenge him. And then be this, you know, laid back hippie woman. She's like the the epitome of everything that he wants out of just a willing sexual being.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting about this too, is they Mad Men does their drug episodes, but this wasn't really, they sort of snuck this drug episode in. It wasn't really a drug episode. It was more of a drug scene. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I thought, I was really hoping that after Don and Betty's little tryst last week, that or last month, because we're a month apart, that Don, that helped, I felt like that really helped Betty in her relationship, and it helped Don in his relationship. Like, he went away from that kind of going like, maybe what I have is good, and I'm trying to be a good father here, and I'm trying to do the right thing. But when he was in L.A., and we saw him making out with that woman, I was like, no, Don. And then we saw Megan, I realized the whole thing was a dream, and now the whole thing was a dream. Do we think you actually kissed that girl, or
totally.
Was that a dream?
Yeah, of course.
I think it turned into a dream when he turned to Megan, and Megan was here.
Oh, no.
I think everything was real up till that point.
Do you think there was
some guilt then, because he kissed that girl, then he turned and he saw Megan? That's what I
maybe
thought.
Maybe that's what
he said. Because I think he was, because it seemed like from the earlier part of the episode that he, and even from last week a bit, that he's trying.
He's still trying. At the end of this episode, he's still trying.
When he saw that vision of Megan, my impression was, yes, he, good old Don, saw an opportunity. He was going to go for it. But this time, her vision there made, there was guilt that came in. That's what I interpreted it as.
It could be guilt. It could also be that, you know, being faced with the prospect of yet another empty pleasure, it awakened in his mind the question, what would I really want?
Let me ask you a question. Do you guys really think Don feels guilt?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I do.
Yes.
I personally do.
Racked with it.
I don't think he has guilt. That's my two cents. I don't know, for whatever it's worth. Yeah. But, maybe?
If he doesn't feel guilt, why did he see PFC Dinkins, who went off to die with Don's lighter in his pocket?
I don't think that... Well, how is Don responsible for PFC Dinkins going off?
No, this is Don's repression of this. This is all this Vietnam crap that's happening, all of him not listening, la, 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 la. He's taking it all in. He's very much paying attention to what was going on in Chicago. He's very much taking all this in. Everyone around him's like, Don, this is going crazy. Joan's crying at home. Megan's crying. Don seems up. But we see in Don's hallucination, this does affect him.
He's just trying not to feel.
No, I get it, but I don't think that that's the same as... I was saying specifically, I don't think he feels guilt about cheating on Megan. I don't think that bothers him.
I don't.
But whether or not he had an emotion about Dinkins being dead or his vision of Dinkins being dead, I think that's a different issue.
I think that it's very much connected, because here's this young kid marching off to die... And you know, Don, you know, could have been that person. Don Draper, the original Don Draper, was that person who went off and died in a war far from home. And here is our Dick Whitman, our Don Draper. Who deserted a war and is free to sleep with women that are not his wife and make money and make ads and go to Hollywood parties. And I think that he is very, very deeply affected by this young man who went off to die and will never have those freedoms. And he's wasting his life, and he knows it, but he doesn't know what the first thing about changing his behavior. He's that entrenched.
I think that's what Dinkins represented. I mean, he was a double whammy. Like, he appeared to him without an arm. He's like, where's your arm? He's like, well, I'm dead. You're dead, dude. No arm. You're dead.
But he said you should see what you're going to look like.
Didn't you sort of almost refer to, but look what you look like? I almost felt like it was kind of a part of that vision was a kind of a death wish.
Jacob Marley action right there.
Yeah. I mean, obviously part of that. And when he did end up in the pool,
He
was looking at himself in the pool. So there was a whole kind of death wish going on with that whole trip he had. Wasn't there? Didn't you get that?
That felt very...
And also, I don't know if he, obviously we assumed he fell in the pool, but I mean, it seemed to have come from a vision of almost...
Not until you said that right now. That's a great point.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's not very Christmas, what do you call it? Jacob Marley.
Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol.
Yeah, but here's what I think. I think that it's very much connected to the guilt over men like Dinkins. And the guilt over the original Don Draper. It's the reason why he wants to die or has this internal, you know, self-destruction. He feels guilty that he's alive and Don Draper isn't. Because Don Draper might have lived a good life.
Yeah, and don't forget, there was also, I thought, quite interesting in this party scene. Remember when he was kissing that girl and she called him Don? She said, he said, my name's not Don.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I told you my name's not Don. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good one. Because when he's in California, he's always been Dick Whitman
California. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, just getting back to that vision, I think maybe at that point he was Dick Whitman because, you know, the sort of taking on the fact that Dick was no longer there because, like I said, he said, because I think he actually said, look at you, like it was referring to the fact that you are dead. Look at you.
Yeah, you should see what you look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so that's California. I mean, do you have anything else in California aside from that?
I just wanted to add, just from the Megan side, I thought, just to add a little bit, I thought she is actually handling Don a little better these days, too. Because she almost says to him, you know, when she's talking and she's watching the riots in Chicago, she said, you can go out, you know. Like, almost kind of giving him permission, but I'm not saying to. But the way she was playing with it and also saying, you know, be careful of the actresses out there, it was almost in a slight way, I'm kind of acknowledging this in a little way because I know that you have an eye for other women, but I thought she sort of was handling it well by bringing it up because then, you know, and I was just thinking she's handling him a little better these days.
She's not shutting it out. She's acknowledging his nature.
Yeah. Yeah,
I did like the look at the party now. I did like the way the party.
Fantastic.
I like when they have the thing where there's people who look like people. You're like is that so and so?
Is that
like,
Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah, so there's a lot of. But and I love that first scene, you know, walking the party. It's like, oh, this is diverse. I see like three black people out of the gate. Like, oh, okay, there's afros and this is a party, you know. Yeah. I did like how Danny, is that his name?
Yep, Danny.
Yeah,
Siegel.
Danny and Lotus. If I didn't mention this before, Sonny and Cher. They were totally Sonny and Cher. Lotus was Cher, looked tall and lovely, and Danny was, you know, short with the daishiki on with the glasses. They were so Sonny and Cher. That was interesting. Before we move on to Avon, I do want to talk about, since we're here in Megan, we're here in L.A., there's been a lot of internet buzz.
It's been going crazy.
About this Megan Sharon Tate thing.
Since the last episode, which was a better half, of course, there's this rumor about the fact, well, as we were talking last week, there's a lot of violence going on, so we're in a very violent time. But there's all these rumors going around now that they think that Megan is a Sharon Tate story. So basically,
now,
that was
people out there who don't know that story.
So Sharon Tate was married to Roman Polanski, and of course, Charles Manson, who had this cult following, and he actually, you know, they went up into the house, and of course, Sharon was pregnant. I think she was like 8 or 9 months pregnant at the time. She was murdered, as were I don't know the number of how many others were murdered, but of course, a very
tragic. In the house was helter-skelter,
helter-skelter. Yeah, it's been documented many times. So there's, of course, there's no parallel there because Don Draper is not a director, but they're finding
he is a creative director.
Creative director, and also they're in New York and not in LA.
And hopefully, there's no cult leader on the horizon.
Yes, but I think the way this got picked up is because there was a scene where Megan was wearing this T-shirt where she was on the on their apartment on their patio with this red star, which is actually the Vietnam star, and that was the same T-shirt that Sharon Tate was wearing in this Esquire shot.
Right.
And then apparently, I think it was the daughter of the photographer, kind of talked to the costume designer of Mad Men saying, was that a coincidence? And the costume designer said it was no coincidence.
Uh-oh.
And that's when the internet thing blew up. Because
of course,
it's like,
Then we also had Sally Draper reading
Rosemary's Baby,
which was a famous movie directed by
Robin Polanski. So. And apparently when Sharon got shot in this T-shirt, that was when he was shooting Rosemary's Baby.
And
so
now
there's
this
all
week,
these...
And now this week we have this vision of her pregnant.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, all this is, we're getting into some Oliver Stone, maybe Mike August territory here. There's a lot of leaps being drawn here, but I, you know, I'm into it. This is kind of what the show's all about is, you know.
I love the way everyone gets so passionate about sort of reading all this stuff into it. So, but yeah, that, I don't know.
So let's talk about the client number two, the big client, Avon.
And then
we have a Peggy, Pete.
This is Joan stepping up.
Pete, situation. So Joan is out on a set up on a date, which turns out to inadvertently turns out to be a client meeting, which she really does a good job of wrangling this guy in and getting a good lead. She takes it into the office, thinking this may be her big shot to be to being the account executive on this, and she's sort of got a rude awakening through office politics. And then what you can pick it up from there.
Yeah, well, I love the fact that I think Joan was surprised too. I mean, she stepped up because I think she realised there was an opportunity. But you're right. I think she just thought this was a date. This is sort of using her feminine wiles. And then she suddenly realised she was getting a lot more respect from this guy.
Right.
That he actually respected her views. And that's when I think it was like, because I think the storyline with Joan's been really great this season.
Yeah.
And I mean, you just feel for her so much because on the one hand, she's this incredibly confident, amazing woman, but her self-esteem is just constantly battered by everyone around her, you know, that puts her still in this role of being the secretary, puts her in this role of only being able to use her sexuality to get anywhere. And I think finally in this episode, she realizes, you know, if no one else is going to break that mold that they have of me, I have to do it.
Right.
Yeah. And she does it in a sort of underhanded way, but I sort of understand that was her only course at that point. I mean, if she did the office politics, she let Pete take, and who was being so obnoxious to her anyway. Mm-hmm. If she let that go, this was an opportunity that she would have let go. And I think she did the right thing. Do you think she handled this right, or do you think in the situation? I don't think she had another choice.
I think. Well, first of all, I just want to acknowledge Christina Hendricks for doing it. I think she's done a great job this season.
Yes, Jones, amazing.
Season, but the acting here, because usually Joan is very subtle. Yeah. Joan is Joan, but we see Joan. We now that we know who Joan is, we can peel back the layers within the Joan and the surface and see her doing her thing underneath, which has been great. And to see that moment at the table where she realizes, like,
I can handle this.
The way that was played was great.
Big shout out to Spencer Garrett, who's a good friend of mine that played the Avon rep. He's awesome, and he does a bitch in Christopher Walken, in case you guys are all curious. Some would say that Spencer Garrett's Christopher Walken was stolen by Kevin Spacey. It's happened. Right. Some have said it.
Bitchin'?
So big shout out. What's that?
Bitchin'?
Yeah, it's 1982 in my head.
Right. Okay.
That spot was amazing. Like when she realizes this man is not into me sexually, this is not what this is.
This is a business meeting.
Right. Mm. And she you can see her make that choice. You're 100% right. I'm going to choose something better. I'm choosing to be of more value in a different way.
And it was all on her face. And it's completely well played.
And I like the line. I think he said, "What do you do?" She said, "I think of things before other people think of them."
Damn right.
I think of the things that people need before they know they need them.
Well, to answer your question, I think in that moment, I think Joan handled everything perfectly in that moment.
Yeah.
When she got back and she talked to Peggy about it.
She did the right
thing.
Everything
was perfectly handled. And then when they were, she was sort of like crushed by Pete and Cha, sort of saying like, "Well, you can't handle this." And at that moment, I'm like, "Oh no, give the poor gal a chance." Yeah. But as we saw at the dinner, like, you know, Joan's not ready necessarily. She's ready, but there's the nuances of this thing that there's a reason why there is a protocol. There's a reason why Pete Campbell is Pete Campbell. Say what you want about Pete Campbell, you know, he could have closed that guy. And there's a moment at the table where she's like, "Joan, what do we do now?" I mean, I'm sorry, Peggy?
Peggy, yeah.
What now, Peggy? Peggy's like, "Ugh." You know, so I don't know. I think she did the right thing. I think we're all rooting for her, but I think the reality of the situation came crashing in.
And I mean, you know, you've got Peggy really, I mean, the girls stood up. And I mean, I like the fact that Peggy really, at the time, you know, when Joan was really getting it in the boardroom that, you know, you've done the wrong thing. How can you? And she didn't know what to say. Mm. And I love the way that Peggy, even though she didn't agree with what Joan did, she stepped up and kind of, she came in with that note, which was brilliant thinking, and saved the day.
Girl power.
Girl power.
Yeah, I love that moment again, well played, well acted by both of them. Like in that moment where, you know, Peggy realizes that she doesn't know what she's doing. They have the confrontation at the office where it's sort of a breakdown of Joan. Joan's too proud to admit that, like, maybe I did F this up.
Yeah.
And Peggy's trying to tell her without being like, and also being pissed about the situation because it's Avon. And then they have that fight, which you're thinking, oh, but in the end, they really got each other's back. And they're two girls, and the only two women in the office. And it all, and again, like
wow.
I said,
that mattered.
That, no, I'm sorry. The only two, well,
wow.
All right. The women that have been in the office together the longest.
Fine.
All right. And they realize they have each other's backs. And then, like I said at the beginning, it started off in turmoil, but it all ended up okay, which is kind of great. Like, it's just, you zoom out, it's just another day at the office, which I love about it.
Well, as long as Peggy said to her, as long as this Avon guy actually calls
as long,
you.
Yeah, as long as Spencer calls.
Do we think that Avon will call?
Yes, I think Avon will call.
I think Avon will call.
I think it's a toss-up. It's a better show if they call.
It is a better show if they call. Let's jump into MASH.
One extra thing to say about Avon. I love the fact that they brought one thing I was going to say about all these clients is they're still very kind of establishment old clients, you know, and even but Avon, I thought, brought in the fact that, you know, we don't know who to sell to.
Love
are
that.
We going, you know, are we going nostalgic or we're going to kind of like get the hippies?
Are we
going to
get groovy?
Yeah. I thought that was interesting because I think a lot of the clients that they've been working with, it's still very traditional, very kind of preaching to the, you know, old school mums and dads and
right.
that. Where I'm kind of curious if they're going to bring in some newer products because they're still working on very kind of old traditional products in
right.
a way. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see.
Mm.
So, speaking of old traditional products,
yes,
Manischewitz.
Manischewitz, one of the oldest
tradition.
Yeah, Manischewitz. If you can get your hands on some, it's good.
Really?
Right now, I think we're 5773. It's a good vintage.
Right.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So just a quick setup on this. This is an existing client of SCDP's. Mm. This is one of Sterling's guys. Sterling's longstanding
yeah.
clients. He's off in LA. This is supposed to be a situation where Cutler is supposed to go handle this with Ginsburg, who he just got in a fight with.
Yes.
So he decides that he's going to give it to your boy.
Bob Benson.
Bob Benson.
Bob, snake in the grass, or is he
yeah.
Benson? We learned a lot this week, and I'm just going to lump this into Benson Watch right now. We are officially in Benson Watch territory. So we have Cutler, who is you know already not crazy about kind of like picking up Roger's scraps while he's away. He's feeling underserved. He goes to talk to Ginsburg about Manischewitz and see the work. And Ginsburg is too riled up listening to everything that's going on at the convention and the fact that they're not going to stop the war to care. And they have this big blow up fight. And as after Ted tells him that he can't just fire Ginsburg, Jim does the next best thing for him, which is just to step back and wash his hands of the whole thing.
It's a beautiful spot. If he sends Benson and Ginsburg, and they both get they screw it up, they can fire them both.
Exactly.
I win.
Exactly. He's playing very tactically, and we're seeing a lot of his process. We're not seeing a lot of his process. A lot of it is left off the screen, which to me is a very interesting move because it's going to make. It makes him more compelling as a potential villain, and it makes us more intrigued about his process. Now we've got Benson and Ginsburg, and we see the scene in Benson's office where he is listening
yes.
to a self-help record.
He is.
A mantra to help him not fail at business. The exact title escapes me, but it was something like how to prevent failure in business,
right.
which looked a lot like how to succeed in business without really trying.
Yes.
And there's an excellent comparison to be made between Bob Benson, who appears to be faking it till he makes it, and
sure.
trying to get off, get ahead through cunning, effort, and general decency, mm-hmm. which we have potentially mistaken as guile. I think he's kind of a guileless person. He's just so determined to get ahead that it's kind of working. Do you know what I mean? Bit by bit by bit. And he's just trying to stay in the game. He doesn't know that much. And yeah. we made the point, Robert Morse, who...
Yes, of course.
The original J. Pierpont Finch? Piedpont Finch.
Yeah.
Say it fast and no one will know.
Okay, exactly.
From how to succeed in business.
He was yeah. superb in that role.
Right.
So
he did exactly the same thing.
He's repeating this mantra to himself, and Stan comes and gets him. Ginsburg's having a fit because what Cutler had revealed to him earlier, that he is a cog in the machine, screwed his shit up something fierce.
We broke Ginsburg. The mirror showed up to mirror to Ginsburg. Ginsburg broke down.
The hilarious thing to me is he's like, he mentions, have you had one too many funny cigarettes? He's like, I don't touch that stuff. That stuff
make
makes
you crazy.
Crazy.
Awesome.
And by the way, I love that scene. I love that, like, fresh off of his inspirational. His self-help record, if you self-help LP, he goes right in there and gets Ginsburg off the floor.
Yeah. He Tony Robbins him up.
His ass up. And I love, he's just, you know, the funny cigarettes. And I'm like, this guy, that's the moment both Matt and I had the same moment. I'm like, this guy is for real.
He's not
a snake in the grass.
He's just kind of a rube.
Yeah.
You know?
Really,
he's a small town guy in the big city trying to make his way. And he's, you know, he just doesn't really understand when he's being too much or being too forward or, you know, like trying too hard. Whereas, you know, these cynical New Yorkers see it for what it is. They don't think of him as a decent person. They're like, dude, you're trying too hard. Come on.
Can we then change Benson Watch?
Yes. Benson Watch is dead. Uh-huh. Long live Cutler Watch.
Oh, man.
Right.
We have three episodes of Cutler Watch.
One is killed, God. And one is born. Yes. Another shall rise.
I am become death, destroyer of Benson Watch.
So fair enough. I was going to say
that Benson is very smooth. I like when he covered for Cutler, because it was pretty clear to anyone who took a look at it that Cutler threw Benson and Ginsburg under the bus.
One arm.
Yes.
The whole plan was for them to F up the whole deal and lose the account. And so when he went in there and he said, you know, and Chaw looks over at Cutler like, what the hell? You sent them? And Benson says, I talked him into it. I insisted. And then of course, Cutler turns around and says, hey, you're on Chevy. Merry Christmas. Like, yeah. That was very smooth. Little give you some love back. But I thought that was a smooth little moment.
It was a smooth little moment for him, but also for Cutler, who I think, you know, as he's starting this kind of covert civil war, he wants Benson on his side. As much as he doesn't like him, having him as a pawn is a better position for him to be in.
Like I said, and when we were watching it, there's no way for him to lose. If they lose the account, he wins. If they keep the account and he can get Benson on his team, he wins. Either way, it's a win-win. It was a smooth move. I was impressed.
Yeah. I mean, they still did lose the account, but it didn't matter. Roger knew they were going to lose it anyway.
Yeah, it's been coming for months.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure Jim loved, that he was supposed to go cozy up to this client that Roger knew was going to leave anyway.
Right, I'm going to go try and make out with a chick who's on life support. Thank you. Right. Thank you for that.
Roger's
I got a girl for you. She's over there in the bed. Yeah, she got some machines hooked up to her. She's for you.
And to put a bow on it, at the end of the day, Benson gets promoted and, you know, orders a store. They change the name to SC.
And P.
And P. And everyone's happy, presumably.
Yes.
Until next week.
Until next week, when a lot of stuff is going to happen.
So let's get into Mike August's super fan. Mike August's catches of the week. You know, Mike August is a guy who has our back, because we watch these episodes fresh, and then we run right into his studio, and then we start yapping about them with scribbled notes together. So we don't have the time to go into extreme detail and depth and really think of things completely through and maybe catch everything. So Mike Benson does that. Mike August does that for us. And last week's episode, The Better Half, he had some catches for us.
Yes. Lieberman. Bob Benson was seen wearing shorts with sharks on them. Symbolic of Bob being a predator, he is circling the blood in the water and trying to get close to a weakened Pete Campbell. As we've learned in this episode, that may not in fact be the case. He's just a decent guy with a big heart.
And some cool shorts.
And some cool, cool shorts. There were several references to cowboys and Indians through the episode. Interesting, as Peggy is really playing an office game of cowboys and Indians, as she doesn't know which side to take between Don and Ted.
Mm-hmm.
She is caught right in the middle. I found it interesting that there were police sirens audible in the background during the two scenes in Don's apartment following the scenes with Peggy and Abe. I was thinking crime is everywhere, and was a nice compliment to the scene in the crash of Grandma Ida visiting Don's apartment. The apartment locations also tie into the discussions of margarine, as one is far more expensive, but they are still the same in many ways. That's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
For some history regarding the 1927 Yankees, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig were both Goliaths of baseball, but the Babe made $70,000 that season compared to Gehrig making far less at $8,000. Applying meaning to the show, Peggy is certainly undervalued in comparison to Ted and Don. Perhaps she was wearing green in the final scene as a symbol of envy. And perhaps it was a television first seeing a character get stabbed twice in the same episode, referring to poor Abe.
Poor Abe.
Well, he's kind of a jerk.
Hey.
He's writing that article about Peggy. Yeah.
Do we think the article will come back? Thank you, Mike August, by the way. Thank you for those. Those were all excellent. Do we think that article is going to resurface, by the way?
It would have been published by now, wouldn't it?
I don't know. It's been a month. You never know. I mean, I think it'll be, you know, great for the show if that article comes back.
Yeah.
Peggy's reading like Abe. Yeah.
Well, I think we saw in the if I can make a quick prediction. I mean, we saw
You want to do it pre-predictions?
I feel like we have a section about predictions.
Well, then I'll save what I was going to say.
Well, I think we'll do just one item. We have one news item.
Okay.
AfterBuzz TV News.
Wow.
That's it.
I love it. Well, Disney announced this week the start of production for a movie called Million Dollar Arm.
Yes.
And that will be starring John Hamm. And it's directed by an Aussie director, Craig Gillespie, who did Lars and the Real Girl, which starred the wonderful Ryan Gosling. And this is actually based on a true story about this. I guess he was like a sports agent. That was failing. And he decided to go to Mumbai, where they were playing cricket. And actually sort of held like a big competition and found these people to bring back. I think a couple of people won this competition. 40,000 people applied to come back and actually learn about baseball.
They found some what they call bowlers over there that were actually pitchers and brought them back and then and try to get them pitched for. I think it was the Pittsburgh Pirates, if I'm not mistaken. But it's a great story. I feel like a bit of a commercial because that is done by the Walt Disney Company, which is my employer. But and I also have a cricket. I have a cricket documentary coming out for Grantland on the Compton Cricket Club. So look
there
for that
go,
in the next
perfect.
Couple weeks. So Disney's doing a lot of cricket.
Cricket. I love cricket for Americans. I love it.
Me and John Hamm. That's all we're just doing cricket.
I know.
We're the same.
It's about time you guys learned a little bit about cricket.
Just a couple of Disney guys doing cricket
just
stuff.
Just hanging out.
Me and John Hamm.
Sure.
So that's great. So look for that. That's announced. I'm sure that'll be awesome for those who like sports movies. We all know John Hamm's also a big sports guy, big sports fan, big St. Louis Cardinals guy. So that should be really, really good. Let's jump into predictions.
And now, you're after Buzz TV predictions.
I'm going to start with you, Matt Lieberman, because you have a lot to say there.
Okay. So we saw in, as always, the scenes from next week were fairly, like vague. All little random snippets.
What?
But we did see Peggy rushing the heck out of a door with several locks, which I'm pretty sure was her old apartment with Abe.
Oh.
And it seemed like she was there when she wasn't when she was not supposed to be there. And I think she's definitely, it could very well be that the article comes out and she's going into the apartment to get something back or to vandalize something. Who knows? But I think we're going to see Abe's kind of return, even if he's not on screen. 1968, man, it's just going to keep getting worse out there. Mm-hmm. It's just going to keep getting worse out there. Cutler is going to continue laying track for his grand master plan.
Oh, and Cutler Watch.
Yes, Cutler Watch. And poor Bob Benson is going to get caught in the middle, and I'm so compelled by this development of the fact that he's a rube here, and he's going to be caught in the middle of these titans of business, and he is not going to be prepared. Very excited.
That's a hell of a lot of predictions.
Yes.
I liked his second one.
Catherine, what do you have?
Well, I'm going to predict the Sharon Tate story is not going to happen. Okay. I don't think we're going to get Megan killed off this season. I don't know. I can't see that happening. And I am going to predict that Joan is victorious in the Avon account.
I hope so.
I think that Avon will be calling.
I hope so.
Ding dong.
Get it? I see what you did there. Joe?
I agree with you. I want to agree with Catherine that I do not think the Sharon Tate thing is... it's just not in the show's nature. We don't do big murders on this show. It's not a...
Lane Price.
Yeah, but it was a suicide. And it was tastefully done. He was British.
You know what? You know
that's
what?
Okay.
I think it is going to happen. I think
he's British. He could do that.
When a Brit kills themselves,
can't kill the Americans.
It's inherently tasteful when a British man kills himself.
Yeah. Right. I
think Meghan's dead. I think Meghan.
Really?
And you know what?
Okay.
I'm going to be contrary, and I'm going to say, you know what? It was a time of instability. It was a time of shocking events, and we will be shocked by Meghan's grisly murder.
You have a prediction.
I do. I'm not going to be shocked by Meghan's grisly murder because it's not happening. But here's my prediction. I think Don is going to try to get Meghan pregnant. I think he is going to see this as a premonition. And I think one of the first things he did when he got back in the office, call my wife, get my wife on the phone. Are you pregnant? I think that's coming up. Are you pregnant? If you're not pregnant, let's go ahead and get you pregnant. I think that Meghan is scared to be pregnant because when she got with old Don, it was because he was getting rid of his old wife who had kids.
he also doesn't know about the pregnancy that she almost had.
So I mean, there's a lot going on there, but I think that we're gonna see a Don attempt to impregnate Megan.
Right, well, I got three quick ones for me. Number one, I do think that Megan will be pregnant. In the previews, Betty goes, she's 25, which I feel like that was the thing that her being pregnant. I don't know that. So I agree there. The Sharon Tate thing, I do not think is going to happen. I do not think that Megan will die. I don't think it's Mad Men's going to end two seasons in a row with two deaths. It's a little, you know, Matthew Warner's going to get away from The Sopranos, not go to it. He mentioned, and one of our Grantland guys mentioned this too, that like, you know, The Sopranos, he talked about how they would write themselves into a corner at the end of the season, and they could always get out of it with a murder. Hey, Tony will kill somebody. Like, that's in season. And Mad Men, they had to find a different way to do it. They do it with sex or someone sleep with someone or whatever. But I doubt they'll go back-to-back murders. So that's
It's not back-to-back murders.
Back-to-back deaths. Yeah. I'm sorry. To end seasons. That's just. But who knows? What do I know? But last, I'm really into, this is sort of a larger maybe series prediction. I'm really into what I think this is. Ultimately, the story of Pete Campbell, the ultimate like long game transformation of Pete Campbell. I mean, we see the Pete Campbell we saw from season one and who he's sort of evolving to, especially these last two seasons, like, you know, going through what he's going through with Trudy and going through in business. I think all these lumps he's taken are like growth. You can't grow without this sort of adversity. And I think what you're seeing, all this like frustrated Pete and all this weaselness and all of this happening and all of his exposure to the 60s politics and how upset he was about Martin Luther King, like, just to see him at the end, after all his normal whiny Pete Campbell, but then to sit at the end and take a drag off that funny cigarette and sit there and take it all in and look at the girl slowly in slow motion to Janis Joplin, I'm like, Pete's gonna turn the goddamn corner. So I think I just like the idea of the transformation of
Pete Campbell. Really glad you brought that up, because we didn't touch on Pete, and that was pretty integral to the Joe, way to pick that up, Joe.
Joe, I think you should talk about our finale. Yeah.
Yes, folks, that was also in our news gossip. We are doing a wonderful Mad Men finale, live finale with the cast and some folks and some special guests at the John Lovitz Comedy Club on the 23rd, which is a Sunday, which is the last episode of Mad Men. Please come down, watch it live. You can get tickets on the John Lovitz Comedy Club website. You can get tickets on our website. Any information you need, and go to AfterBuzz.com or JohnLovitzComedyClub.com.
Yeah. You do not want to miss it.
No, we can't discuss who's showing up yet, but you will not be disappointed.
But everyone, a lot of people will be there, but we will all for
and
sure.
And Maria Menounos is hosting.
Yes, and the four of us will be there, and it'll be fantastic. So please, tweet at us. Or anything to get more information on that. Joe, where can we find
you? You can find me on the Twitters at Joe Flippo. You can also find me here with Mr. Joe Braswell. We are doing the Hannibal AfterBuzz show, and that's about it.
Yep.
Oh, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Catherine Tulich, T-U-L-I-C-H. You can read me in the LA Times. You can see my interviews on RogerEbert.com.
Yes.
You can find me on Twitter at Matt Lieberman. That's M-A-T-T-L-I-E-B-E-R-M-A-N. You can find me here on AfterBuzz TV hosting the Defiance After Show, and this summer on Under the Dome and Low Winter Sun, the new AMC series. And you can find my sketch comedy on VLYTV.com.
You can also find Joe Flippo on Escape from Planet Earth, which is available on DVD right now. His voice in it. He's very funny, very good. I'm Joe Braswell. You can find me on Twitter at Joe K. Braswell on Twitter. You can also find me at Grantland.com and also with Hannibal with Joe Sanfilippo.
Brilliant.
That's it. Thank you very much, Marissa Serafini and everyone else. We'll see you next week.
From Bing.com, executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later!
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.